a little hard to know where to stand. This is a smaller group, but it seems like a few of you sort of migrate to places behind me, so I apologize for turning my back to you. When last we met, which is over a month ago, we were working on Genesis, so I'd like to just spend a few moments catching you up to where we were, so I'll go back and do a quick review of part of where we've been so that we can hit the ground running in the new part. If you'll find Genesis 29, the tail end of Genesis 28, Jacob is running from Esau, who has threatened to kill him because of his stealing the blessing from Isaac. He's now on his way to his uncle Laban. And just to sort of orient you a little bit, if this is the Sea of Galilee and this is the Dead Sea, then way over here is the University of Richmond. Okay, it's her. Somewhere in here is Haran, which goes by a couple of different names, and that's where Laban is. And so Jacob had left this area. What's a good name for this area? Promised Land. Okay, or Canaan, as it would be known there. He has gone to Laban's place, right? And the journey begins on verse 29, Genesis 29. He gets to Laban's place, falls in love with Rachel, agrees to work for 7 years for Rachel to be his wife, and the trickster gets tricked. When the wedding night is over, he wakes up the next morning and he's married Leah, not Rachel. And it's a bit of a problem. He agrees to work 7 more years for Rachel to be his wife. He only has to wait a week for the marriage to take place. Now he has the two wives, and as you go through chapter 29, you get to the end of chapter 29, Leah starts having children and Rachel doesn't, and tensions grow. Rachel finally decides to take a page out of Sarah's book, Back with Abraham, so she gives her handmaid, and the handmaid has children, but the same kind of tensions that came with Hagar come here, and the whole thing is just getting crazy, children after children being born, but Rachel still doesn't have any. And the chapter, the section, I should say, the section ends around chapter 30, verse 24, when Rachel gives birth to Joseph. Now, that's about how far we had gotten last time. And what I want to try to do is move quickly through the remainder of chapter 30 and through 31 and get to 32, because chapter 32 has the big piece that we want to get to. Don't want to take too long, but I want to take long enough that you can see some of what's happening. And you could probably argue that a good part of this is Jacob is a con artist, a trickster, a conniver, and he has met his match in Laban, or at least almost. Laban is matching him right down the line. So when Joseph is born, verse 25 of chapter 30, Jacob says to Laban, "Release me, let me go home to my own country. Give me my wives for whom I have worked for you and my children, and let me go. You're well aware of how long I have worked for you." And they keep going. And Laban in this says, "Name your wages." And what you get in the remainder of chapter 30 is basically what sounds like either God's miracles or careful animal husbandry and genetics. Jacob seems to know something about how to breed livestock. And so each time Laban says, "Well, your wages will be the animals that look like this," seems like that's the strongest animals that are born look like that. And then he'll change it. "Well, no, wait, why don't you take these?" And then all of a sudden those are the strongest ones born. And so as this goes through, Jacob's wages are building and building with the strongest and strongest animals, and what Laban has left look like they're weaker and weaker and weaker. And you come to the end of chapter 30. This is verse 42. Laban got the feeble, Jacob got the sturdy, that's the animals, and thus, this is verse 43, the man, that's Jacob, grew extremely rich and came to own large flocks, men and women, slaves, camels, and donkeys. Chapter 31 opens with, not surprisingly, a picture of the tensions that would emerge. What would you be thinking if you were Laban's sons, expecting to inherit Laban's wealth, and you're watching as this interloper from a distance has come in, has married both of your sisters, has a whole bunch of kids, and when you look out at the flocks that are out there, the weak ones, the ones that don't look like they're any good, they're the ones you're going to inherit, and all the really great-looking animals, they belong to this interloper. Well, chapter 31, verse 1, Jacob learned that Laban's sons were saying, what were they saying? You got that? Read it. What does it say? What were Laban's sons saying? Chapter 31, verse 1.
Jacob has taken everything our father owned and has gained all his wealth and what belongs to our father.
Okay, is that true? Of course not. That's hyperbole. That's the way you win arguments, is you overbuild your thing. He hadn't taken everything. He'd just taken the best and the most. And what he's left is a pittance. But the argument is stronger if you say it this way. Okay. Now, verse 2, Jacob saw something else. What did he see? Read it. Scan it. Talk to me. Laban's not real happy with him either. So he's got Laban unhappy with him. He's got Laban's sons unhappy with him. And it might occur to him that it might be time to pick up and leave, get out of this situation. And right there, something happens. This is verse 3. Laban's sons are in verse 1. Laban's in verse 2. What happens in verse 3?
That's when God said to Jacob, go back home where you were born. I'll go with you.
How many encounters has Jacob had with God? His own encounters, not Isaac's, not somebody else's. He just had the one way back there at Bethel. So here's number 2. And what's God doing? God is saying, it's time to go. And not only that, if you go, I'll be with you. Implying what? You'll be okay. You have my protection as you go. Okay? Hold on to that thought. Hold on to that thought. We will need that later. So Jacob had Rachel and Leah call to the fields where his flocks were, and he begins to say, we're going to go. And he rehearses all the gripes that he has with Laban, so we won't take time to go through all of those. But in essence, here we go. Look at verse 14. You realize Leah and Rachel are not all that positive toward Laban either. Rachel and Leah figure they've actually earned some things too. It shouldn't all go to the boys. Maybe the girls ought to get some, and here's the way the girls get some, and so they're game to go as well. And the picture that you have is, in the dark of night, without notifying anybody, they just go. And off they head. Now, how far do they come? We don't know. Not real clear, but they're on their way. And they apparently, there's hints in here that they actually left the tents all standing, probably left a few of the animals around, so that if Laban sort of came, popped up over a hill just to sort of look, see what Jacob's doing today, he would see just enough activity to where it would fool him for a while. So they got several days out ahead before Laban figured out what had happened. Now, if you're Laban, and the best of the cattle and flocks that used to be under your general control have left, your daughters have left, your grandchildren have left, nobody's told you boo, what are you likely to do?
Chase
them. And that's what he did. And he catches them. And the interactions between them, verse 22, 3 days later, Laban was told that Jacob had fled. He pursued them for 7 days, overtook them at Mount Gilead. I don't know exactly where that is, but it's somewhere probably maybe here on this generalized map. He catches up with them. Okay. Now what follows, you can read for the details, but what follows is roughly this. He lets Jacob have it. Finishing with the trump card that he has to play. You took my daughters from me without letting them say goodbye to me. You took my grandchildren from me. How dare you? And Jacob hits back almost as hard. How many times did you change my wages? You would have let me go with nothing if it had been up to you. This is verse 42 of chapter 31. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, the kinsman of Isaac, had not been with me, you'd have sent me away empty-handed. And here they are, butting heads. What's the outcome?
The outcome looks wonderful and peaceful at surface level. If you read through there, it just looks fine. Laban and Jacob have a peace meeting. They draw up a peace contract. Everything's going to be great between us. I want you to dig a little deeper. In my translation, it's called a cairn. This is in verse 52, verse 51. Tail end of verse 50, God is witness between us. Verse 51, Laban said to Jacob, here is this cairn I have thrown up. What's a cairn? Pile of stones. He calls it a pillar in a moment. Yours may call it a tower or something like that. But he builds up a pile of stones. Put them on the ground. And he says, this cairn is a witness. This pillar is a witness. Now read the next few words and see if you can figure out what it says. Read the next few words. What does it say? I am establishing a boundary. You don't ever, ever come to this side again. And I'll promise not to chase you. What happens if Jacob crosses that line? Be harsh, folks. He's dead. And all his stuff comes back to life. Laban said, I'll let you go. But on the principle that I never see you again. How many movies have moments like that? Have you seen those? All right. But don't ever let me see your face again. This town's too big for the two of us. You've heard the cliches like that, right? That's what's happening here. This is not peace and light. This is controlled anger that is going to be unleashed. And what does that do?
That sets up a barrier. Jacob can't go this way anymore. His only choice then is to go this way. Now, it doesn't seem to have occurred to Jacob to go any other direction. When he left Laban, he could have gone north, he could have gone east, he could have gone south. He chose to come back home.
What's back home? Esau. Where's Esau?
Esau is down here in a land called, have you read ahead? In a land called Seir, or as close to that as we're going to get for our pronunciations this morning. This will become known in later days as Edom. And over, must be six or seven times, the Bible says, Esau is Edom. Esau is Edom. So, what does he have? He's got Esau in front of him, the promised land off here to the side, but he can't go back. He can't go back. He can't go to Ur. He can't go to any of the other places. He's made his choice. Okay?
He was told by God to go back
Verse 54, he offered a sacrifice on the mountain. That's one of the few times you've seen Jacob taking an active role in worship and prayer. He invited his kinsmen to the meal. They ate the meal. They passed the night on the mountain. Early the next morning, Laban kissed his grandchildren and daughters and blessed them. Notice he didn't do a thing for Jacob. Notice the omission. Laban left to return home. And now what happens? Another encounter with God's angels, an affirmation that he's in the right direction. So what you've got is you've got Laban's camp back here, you got Esau's camp down here, and Jacob says, this is God's camp here. That's what that name, Mahanaim, means. It means God's camp. This is God's place. So he's had more affirmation. This is the direction you're supposed to be going. I'm going to be with you. All right? Now, it's either verse 3 or verse 4 of chapter 32. He sends messengers ahead to Esau. Where's Esau? In Seir, or something like that. Right? He sends messengers ahead to him, the open country of Edom. And he gives them instructions. Here's what you're supposed to say. And in this, he is very, very humble. Very, very effacing. Your servant, Jacob. Your servant Jacob, all this kind of stuff. What are the messengers going to be doing? They're going to be telling, look, your brother's rich. He's going to have lots of things for you, and there's no need for you to be angry anymore. A few verses later, the messengers return. And they have a message. This is verse 6 or 7 in your translation. What's the message? Six translations say it one way, one says it another way. Esau's on his way. And he's got 400 armed men with him. One translation said he's got an army of 400 men with him. That pretty much captures it correctly. Bible record just says he's got 400 men with him, but the one that implies it's an army, yeah. What's your reaction if you're Jacob? You don't have to guess. You just have to read the next verse.
What does it say? Okay, let's get this. There are two terms used. Greatly afraid. Greatly afraid and
distressed.
Panicked. Okay, now, the other words that are here are panicked. I need to know if panicked is spelled with or without a K in your translation.
P-A-N-I-C-K-E.
Yeah, got a K. There's another word that some translations use back up here.
Fearful.
Oh, fearful, yeah. Mm-hmm. Terrified is what one of them uses. Fearful is not quite catching it. Terrified is better. Okay. Distressed is one scared out of his wits. I don't think that's in a translation, but it's implied. That's sort of where it goes. Here comes Esau with 400 men. Let's review the bidding. What does Jacob have with him? Donkeys. Sheep. Goats. Cattle. Camels. And the little offspring. He's got two wives and two slave wives, and he's got 11 children, because Joseph's the only one that's come from Rachel so far. And some of those are little. How many fighting men does he have to oppose them? Maybe 15 or 20. You know, maybe the four older boys. Right? Maybe some of the servants that have been handling the sheep and such. But, of course, if they don't handle the sheep, then the sheep scatter and all this kind of stuff. He's terrified. So, let's see what he does. I think it's verse 7 in your translation, is that right? He takes several steps. What's his first step? He divides the possessions, the livestock and all the other stuff, into two groups, because he is thinking, Bible doesn't make it guess here. What's he thinking? He can't attack two at once. If he attacks one, maybe the other one can escape.
First step is in grace.
That's the second step in my translation.
Okay.
Does it reverse it in your translation?
Mm-hmm.
In mine, the first step, I think it's in your verse 6 or 7 or 8, he was greatly afraid and distressed. He divided the people with him, the flocks and cattle, into two camps, thinking if Esau comes to one of the camps and attacks it, the remaining camp may be able to escape. And then he prayed.
Okay, you're right.
That's the order I see.
That's 8, okay? And then 9.
Because it's going to take time to do the division, he orders the division done, and then as soon as that happens, he starts praying. How many times have we had in the Bible record him praying so far? 4, 5, 6? Answer, I think, is 0. You might count that sacrifice on the mountaintop as a time of prayer, but we certainly didn't hear his words at that time. He had a reaction to what God's appearance at Bethel and God's appearance at a couple of other places. But actual prayer, I think this may be the first time. And what's the nature of his prayer? How does he start? Yeah, you're not my God yet. You're God of daddy and granddaddy. And then he says, quickly, you told me to go this way. What's going on? But then there's something remarkable. And you see the first break in the facade that Jacob has. You have lavished on me love, faithfulness, and your guidance and your protection, and I haven't deserved a bit of it. I am not worthy of all the love and faithfulness you have shown me. And for the first time, you feel like the old con man is starting to break. Do you see that? By the time he's finished, he's brought it up a couple of more times. You told me to go this way. What's going on? It was you who said, verse 12 or 13, I'll be very good to you and make your descendants like the sand of the seas, which is too numerous to count. Esau's coming with 400 men. He's only got 11 children. That's way more than Isaac or Abraham had. but they could all be dead by noon tomorrow. You told me I was going to have descendants. They could all be dead tomorrow. What's going on, God? But in the middle of that is this sense of, I'm not worthy of the love you've shown me. A little bit of a break here. Now, at the end of that prayer comes a sentence that in my translation is six words. Then Jacob passed the night there. Did you ever say that? What's coming in the morning? Esau and 400 men. And he can't even stop shaking for the fear of what that could mean. So what does he do? Well, he obviously goes to sleep, gets a good night rest, right? You're terrified, it's easy to sleep, right? Talk to me.
No.
So what does he do? He probably tried to go to sleep. Then he wakes up. And what does he do? He starts doing things. What's the first thing he does? Yeah. Mine says he sends a gift. He chose a gift for his brother Esau. But when you get finished, the gift has at least four parts, if not eight parts. He sends him breeding herds, males and females, of cattle, of sheep, of camels, of donkeys. Do you see that? And he sends them out in groups. I don't know if it's the camels in one group and the donkeys in another, or if it's the female camels and then the male camels. It's at least four groups, maybe eight groups, each with herdsmen with them. And what are they supposed to say when they encounter Esau? Remember, this is the middle of the night. They're off. They're going. And what are they supposed to say? This is a gift from your servant Jacob, and he's right behind us. So what's Esau going to do? He's heading for Jacob, so he'll let those people go. And then he'll encounter another. By the time he gets to four gifts or eight gifts, maybe his anger will be assuaged. Then what does he do? We're now down to verse 22 or verse 23, and my translation says that same night. Does yours say that? Mm-hmm. That same night. What does he do? Takes his wife and his children, his wives and his children. The wives, the slave wives, and the children. Takes them where? Across to the other side of a river called what? The Jabbok River, 65 miles long. It is the boundary between two nations. Deep, deep ravines with the water coursing through those violently, or so I'm told. If I get over there, it's a little creek. I've been fooled. What's the name of the river?
Jabbok.
Anybody look at that name and notice anything? It sounds like a play on words, a play on letters in Jacob's name, doesn't it? If you start playing around with the letters in Jacob's name, Jabbok is one of the things you'd get. I have no idea if that has significance, but something else does. Let me stop and get you started. Where's Esau coming from?
Seir. What does Seir mean? Judy, this is for you. You know what this means? Who's down here?
Esau.
Esau's down here. What does that name mean? I did not know this until this week.
No.
It means...
Harry.
Harry and Ruff.
Your kids.
What a name for the country where Esau comes from. But eventually they turned it into Edom. And that's not a cheese, that's a country. They call it Edom. But right now it's called Seir. And the name Seir means Harry and Ruff. What's the number one main thing we know about Esau? He's hairy and rough. What do we infer about those 400 armed men that are with him? They're probably hairy and rough too. Is this starting to be interesting? I had not seen that. Yeah, I'm trying not to go there because I don't really understand how that all fits in it, but he's over 70.
He was
70
when he was
young. Yeah, he may be older than that. Yeah. Somehow that doesn't seem to matter. So here come the hairy and the rough And he's spending the night, and the last thing he does is he fords this river with his children and his wives. He puts them there, and he goes back on the other side of the river. And he is now fully and totally alone, just as he had been when he went the other direction earlier. And in about 5 verses, or 6 verses, or 7 verses, it goes from verse 22 or 23 to the end of the chapter. I guess that's 10 verses. You all of a sudden have one of the most important passages in the whole of the Old Testament. Because what happened that night changed everything. He is all alone. He's prayed his prayer. God, when I came this way, all I had was a stick and a little bit of clothes, a little bit of food. And now I've come back. I've got so many possessions, it takes two camps to hold them all. And wives and children besides. You have made me wealthy and I didn't deserve a bit of it. But by this point, all of his wealth and all of his possessions are spread out as a buffer barrier. And he's hiding it in fear on the other side of this river. And what happens? Read it. What happens? A man comes to him. By the time this gets through, by the time these 10 verses are over, Jacob will have told you who he thinks this man is. Who is it? I saw God face to face. And what happens during the night? They wrestle. What's the name Jabok mean? Anybody want to take a guess? It's the wrestling river, because it describes the way the river is doing that. It's actually got 4 names. One is emptying, because it's sending so much water into the Jordan Valley. It's called slipping away, and it's called wrestling. He's by the banks of the river. I didn't know that till this week. I saw this thing on Seer, and I said, man, I better check every name in sight. It's called the wrestling river. Okay, bunch of questions. Let's see where we can go with this. The first time the Bible talks about Jacob, what was he doing? He was wrestling with his brother Esau in the womb. This is his lifestyle. When he was growing up, he was wrestling psychologically, not physically, but psychologically, with his brother for the birthright. He and his mom made a tag team against Isaac for the blessing. And oh Lord, has he been wrestling with Laban on the wives? There was sort of a tie. He's been wrestling all his life. This is nothing new, but the opponent's new. What kind of a wrestling match is this? Is it physical? Sure as heck sounds like it. Is it only physical? I don't think so. What else is involved? Psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, at least those. But physically too. Jacob is on a road of his own choosing. Road of self-will, a road of selfish goals. A road where he puts only his own strength and resources to play in anything he faces. And here he is at the banks of the wrestling river with nothing left. It's amazing what we've already talked about. Mm-hmm. Now, there is a sentence here I do not understand. When dawn broke, just as day was breaking, the Bible says something. What does it say? The man with whom he wrestled realized something. Read it. Talk to me. What does it say? He couldn't win against Jacob. Mm-hmm. Looks like he couldn't lose either, but he couldn't win. That is a fascinating sentence, and I do not know what it means. He says to Jacob, let me go. And what does Jacob say? I will not let you go until you bless me. And a response comes. And what's the response? It is a question from the man with whom he wrestles? That is the most awful question he could possibly have asked, and the roof caves in on Jacob. The last time he was trying to get a blessing, his daddy Isaac said, "Who are you?" And what did Jacob say? "I'm your son, Esau, your firstborn." Must have asked that two or three times. And in the middle of this, he says, the voice is Jacob, but the hand is Esau's. Because when he felt the hand, what did he feel? He felt hairy and rough. And here by the banks of the Jabbok River, the wrestling river, he says, "I will not let you go till you bless me." And he says, "Who are you?" And what's his reply? If you cannot feel the power of this moment in Jacob's heart, the rest of the facade breaks away. What does he say? "I am the schemer. I am the one who grasps from behind. I'm the conniver, the scared mama's boy, the con man, the self-centered, self-serving, selfish, self-sufficient one. That's who I am." And the blessing comes in the form of a new name. What's the new name? And I've said for years that it means Prince of God, and I'm wrong. Anybody want to guess what it means? The one who struggles with, wrestles with, contends with. You want the $4 word, use contends. You want the 5 cent word, use wrestles. That's what Israel means. That's different from what I thought. I learned a lot about words this week and the meaning of those words.
It has been a continuous thing too.
Always struggling. We got about 10 minutes to wrap this together. Let's see how we do. Jacob, Israel limped after that night. Why? Guy knocked his hip out of socket. And he limped from that day forward. A physical reminder of this night. How would you describe this night? What's the phrase that people use for this? Dark night of the soul. Epiphany is the result. It's not the night. The epiphany and the change is what comes out of it. It's the dark night of the soul. And in that night, he wrestles with God. And somehow in that wrestling, he ends up holding on to God so tightly that when God asks him to let go, he refuses. Refuses until you give me a blessing. I don't know where all to go. But I want to remind you, this is one of the high points of the whole of the Old Testament. A night of wrestling with God leads to a change of name, a change of nature, a change of attitude, a change of condition, a change of behavior, a change of outcome and lifestyle. Everything changes after this night. And our limping man finally becomes what God wanted him to be. I didn't say this in the first hour, ran out of time. Don't forget that hundreds of years later, when God meets Moses on that mountainside next to the burning bush, and Moses says, "What's your name?" God says, "I'm the God of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob." And he doesn't say Israel. He says Jacob. Something happened that changed this guy forever, and that changed the influence he had on people. So Esau comes. What are the next words after this night is over? My translation, Jacob looked up. And what did he see? Esau and his 400 men. And there doesn't seem to be panic anymore. He still bows and scrapes. He still identifies himself as your servant, your servant, your servant. But what happens when they meet each other? Who runs to who? Esau runs to Jacob. What do they do? Two parts. They embrace or hug, and they both weep. Strong men weeping because what has been broken appears to have been restored a little. A little. What does Esau say? Come on home with me. I'll take good care of you. What does Jacob say? I'm on my way. Esau says, I think I'll tag along. Make sure you don't lose your way. Jacob says, you don't need to do that. But I tell you, I can't make very fast time. All these little animals that I have, if we try to push them, all the animals will die. There's some hyperbole for you. All the animals will die if we try to push them. You go on ahead, we'll follow. Esau says, fine, I'll leave some of my men to make sure you don't get lucky. You don't need to do that. You've got more important things to do for you. Take them on. We'll be right there. Okay?
So, they're at the banks of the Jabbok River. Where does Esau go? He goes back home. Where does Jacob go? The Succoth, and then the Shechem, and then the Bethel. I think I've got the place more or less right. Does he ever go to Seir? No, he does not.
Did he lie to Esau? You bet. Long practice, he's good at it. But he's also doing what? He's heading where God wanted him to go. Chapter 33 ends with him in a place called Shechem. And he bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, the father of the city of Shechem, it seems like, a piece of land on which he pitched his tent and erected an altar, and he worshiped God. And what name does he give God? Please don't miss this. I forgot to say this in the first hour. What name does he give God? I'm at the end of chapter 33. Are you? He erected an altar which he called El. That's God. Does it translate it for you?
No.
Really?
Mighty is the God of Israel.
Mighty is the God of Israel. It's no longer granddaddy's God. It's no longer daddy's God. He's my God. Until that transformation comes, each generation is in danger of losing its relationship with God. God can't be my parents' God. He has to be my God. And that transformation seems to have come in this encounter. Mighty is the God of Israel, I think, is the translation of what's there. Okay? We will pick up the story when we come back. Your job is to read chapter 34, 35, 36. See if you can get to chapter, to the end of chapter 38, and we'll be okay. These are not pretty chapters. There's pretty ugly stuff in here. We got to get past this so we can get to the story of Joseph, and I think there's some things in here which we need to note. One of the most important things to note is the Bible does not tell you all the good things about its character. It tells you about the Bible characters, warts and all. And there's some things in here that aren't attractive. We've already seen some. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, people face nights by the wrestling river. And our hardest wrestling is when we wrestle with you. We don't pretend to know what the words mean in the Bible record, but we got a pretty good idea of what it means when we wrestle with you and when we wrestle with the things that terrify us in the dark of night. We pray that you would be with us. We pray that you would engage us in a way that doesn't end until we have a kind of relationship with you that leads to a different kind of behavior, that makes our relationship with you a part of all we are and of all we do. We thank you for the example of Jacob, who becomes your person when finally he realizes his need to hold on to you. But we also realize that you promise that you hold on to us. All this we pray in your Son's name. Amen.